This is the Technology Evangelist with Scott Schweitzer, and thank you for listening. Today's show is brought to you by Solarflare. In March, Solarflare is releasing their X2 line of secure 10 and 25 gigabit Ethernet NICs in both PCIe and OCP form factors. Unlike other performance NICs, this line is tamper-resistant and includes free line rate packet filtering and OS kernel bypass. To learn more, please visit solarflare.com. Hello, this is Scott Schweitzer, Technology Evangelist, and today we're lucky enough to have Brantley Coyle, entrepreneur, founder, and CEO of Corey, the ATA over Ethernet guys. So, Brantley, we've known each other for almost a decade now. Do you want to reflect back on how we met?
It's been a while, Scott. Yes, we met when you were with a company called Miracom, and we wanted to do, as Corey, we wanted to do 10 gig Ethernet really early. I do think it was about 2007. And I looked around, and we looked at several different vendors, and I liked the Miracom stuff the best of what was available back then. And then, you know, you showed up in Athens, Georgia.
What I found interesting about that first meeting was you guys were toying with Plan 9?
Yes. So I'm an old Unix guy. I used to be an old Unix guy. Now I'm an old Unix guy. The hair and the beard, the ponytail and the beard now are very gray. But I come from a Unix background, and the guys that invented Unix were all at Bell Laboratories. And Linux, of course, is a copy of Unix. And, you know, even Windows are kind of a copy. Mac is built on Unix based on the Berkeley stuff. So the Unix was very influential. Modern computing basically came out of this group in Murray Hill, New Jersey, that worked for Bell Laboratories. And they did an operating system after Unix called Plan 9. You've heard of the bad movie Plan 9 from Outer Space. Well, this is the great operating system, which was Plan 9 from Bell Lab. We've been working on our version of it for, well, gee, it's about almost over 20 years now. And we've tuned it for the kind of products we make, the storage products, and we use it in our development. And we also use it on our web. On back of our web, because it's probably the best and least known cloud operating system in the world.
Wow. One of the things that always impressed me about your background was you were the guy behind the original Cisco PIX firewall. Is that correct?
That's right. A friend of mine and I started a company called Network Translation originally to solve a problem that people had in the mid-90s. They had installed TCP/IP in their companies. And the actual internet, though, was not very well known. So they just made up a bunch of IP addresses. So instead of going to the authorities and getting a proper IP address, they just made them all up. And they were beginning to come to us and say, hey, we need to change all these IP addresses because we want to connect to the internet. And we can't do it because we are using Coca-Cola's IP address by accident. And, you know, so the guy I co-founded NTI with was doing some admin stuff. And he asked me, is there any way to fix this with some sort of product? And I said, of course. And I had implemented TCP/IP a couple of times already by that point, and I quickly saw how we could do it on the fly and very fast. So what we did was is we implemented a product we call the Private Internet Exchange that later got to be called the PIX. And it was the first commercial network address translation box, NAT. Out of that work also came Martian addresses, what's called Martian addresses, which is the reason you can, you know, win drinks at the bar and impress people at cocktail parties by predict what IP address they've got at home. Most people don't realize everyone has 192.168.1.1. And when we did the NAT part, we realized that you can do the firewall part very easily with the same data structures we were using. And we sold that to Cisco Systems in the very end of 95. And then I followed that up with the local director. So we kind of had four things, really. We had the first, I invented network address translation, which everybody's using now. I invented the stateful packet inspection firewall, which is what everybody uses now. And I invented virtual private networks. We were the first VPN product in the world. And also I followed that up with doing load balancing with a product that Cisco called a local director. that would let you load balance inbound stuff, still using kind of the network address translation trick. We still use it. Our product in ChlorAid called the VSX is basically doing storage area networking address translation, create logical volumes. So,
well, thank you four times over for all that great stuff.
You're very welcome.
So I was reading this past weekend your article on LinkedIn that you published, I guess it was Friday, Intel Flubs Again. And you really didn't pull any punches about Meltdown and Speculative Execution and Spectre. Do you want to jump into a little bit about that article?
I got some great friends at Intel, both in the States and in other places in the world. And Intel would just really not like to not have this architecture. I'm sure no one said it officially, but it's got to have been a burden for them for years and years. And it's just that we, the people who use the architecture, Intel, who's building the architecture, are just stuck. There's just nothing either one of us can do about it. And that complex instruction set has, in the need for fast performance, has caused, mixed up with Moore's Law, the advantages of Moore's Law, has caused a situation where we've got this, you know, incredible security breach that's basically caused by the complexity of us all being stuck on that processor. Now, I would argue that Intel would love to not have that processor because they've tried repeatedly to launch new processors. But unfortunately, the entire server world now and the desktop world are all dependent on having hardware that can run DOS, even though nobody uses DOS. most people don't realize it, but when you boot an Intel processor, it thinks it's 1983 and comes up in 16-bit real mode, open mode, just like the PCAT did.
So we're still using 19, 20, 21?
It starts to go into where it's slowly getting later and later. It thinks it's 1983. It can convince itself it's in the early 90s by going to 386 mode. And then finally it comes dragging along into 64-bit mode where he can actually think it's, you know, in the year 2000, right? So it's stuck back in the last century. And since all operating systems have started there, because Intel had to be backward compatible with the old 16-bit stuff in order to run DOS, but then they added Windows. So in order to get Windows to come up, it knew it was going to be boot in 16-bit mode. That 16-bit mode boot has always had to be there and still there. Well, the format of these instructions, the architecture, what's called the architecture of these processors, are slowly accreted instruction after instruction over time as they've added things to it, and it's gotten incredibly complicated and very hard to make to go fast. But, you know, I've always been critical of the instruction set. I've never liked it. All our products are based on it. We know it very well, and it's not their fault. It's a consequence of history.
You know, we've seen this complex instruction set, you know, model, the CISC model. And in parallel to that, for a while, we had the RISC computers, the IBM Power Series, the Sun workstations, MIPS, and all that kind of stuff. And even Intel, you know, came along with the Itanium for a while. I mean, is there any chance they're going to ever get past this kludgy CISC that they've crafted?
I think the company will, but it will be something different. And they've lost the last window to grab. It kind of slipped past them. And that's with the ARM for mobile. So the desktop's it is fading out, and people are using iPads and tablets instead for most things. And those are running a completely different architecture because there's not a direct lineage back to DOS and Windows on that hardware. So it has to be a change like that. And you're right, there were a lot of great processors out there, and they just lost to Intel. And the besides MIPS and Itanium, Intel actually tried the i960, which was out back in the 80s. I remember before that, in the early 80s, they had something called the 432, where they kept trying to launch these smarter, better processors, and just, they, you know, just couldn't get traction. Now the company can. just because they missed the arm window for which has to be very efficient in gate count, because the battery life is the ultimate thing you're struggling with for mobile and iPads. It's battery life you're running against. For servers, you're running against just massive processing speed, in which they win by throwing a lot of gates at it. And if you take CMOS gates and you have a fast clock, you have a lot of current going through it. You know, you can heat your building with these things. So I think they will, to answer your question, I think they could, but it takes a breaking of the continuity or something disastrous, like, I don't know, a major security flaw.
Right. Because, you know, we've seen power has made a run, and my focus has been high frequency trading for a while off and on. And power has made a real run at the high frequency trading crowd and has never really successfully broke in. You know, some people would say it was just purely the economics of the situation. IBM was maybe outpricing themselves from the market. But I always thought that the power architecture was far superior to this and would run circles around it. But just...
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it. You know, the power series is indirectly related to John Koch, who's credited with inventing RISC in the first place. So maybe I could mention what RISC and CISC, what the difference are, and why it's a performance issue, and what led to the disaster that they've got on their hands now with this meltdown. Computers, when they were first created, were programmed in assembler by everybody. Even when they were high-level languages like COBOL and Fortran, people still, especially people like operating system and compiler writers, people who had to write code that had to run very fast, would write the code in assembler. As a result, the design of the instructions, which is referred to as an architecture, was designed to make that easy to do. And it really meant that there was a great deal of attention given to something called addressing mode, how the instruction would reach out into memory and get it. I mean, in some of these processors, by these processors, I'm including IBM 360s, 370s, you know, the old school ones, you would do more computing getting your data than you actually did with the data once you got it. You know, you could have a base register indexed by an index register that was multiplied by 8, and then that's where you added a constant to it, and that's where you loaded data from.
Yep.
The observation was made by John Koch at IBM, your alma mater, where that we don't write software that way anymore. This is in the 70s. We don't write code that way anymore. We actually use a high-level language. You know, they were using something called PLS internal to IBM at the time, which looked a lot like PL1 trimmed down and was kind of not directly influential, but people would sort of see something that looked C-like. So they were writing code with that. So he said, well, the compiler doesn't care about these addressing modes. And if I get rid of those complications and make the instruction set not as ornate, then I can stream them through a pipeline. So in other words, you can have one instruction being fetched while you have the previous instruction being decoded, and the instruction before that actually pulling the data it needs out of registers, and the instruction before that one could already be to the point where he's executing. So you can take these steps that that a instruction would do inside a architecture, and you can get concurrency by having them working at different stages. And this is called a pipeline. A RISC processor can pipeline really well and keep the pipeline busy because it doesn't have these complicated addressing modes. He's not going to read something out of memory and then add it to something. He's going to load it out of memory into a register as one instruction. And then he's going to do the addition from register to registers. And then he's going to store it from a register. So each one of those things fit in the sequence of pipeline very well. It's a way of getting parallelism temporally, right? One at a time. And so RISC does that really well. And Koch built a machine called the 801. And it was an experimental box. And that actually led to the power series and influenced a lot of other people.
No, I was going to say, I was actually at Yorktown IBM Research. The 801 is actually the building ID number.
Aha, Yorktown. Neat.
And the processor was the ROMP processor, R-O-M-P. And Cox's original article, I think, or one of the later ones right after it, he said he could do the whole thing at 160 instructions. I felt like I was playing Name That Tune. I mean, how many instructions could you write your processor yes. in? And it was very interesting. I did a paper way back in the late 80s, I guess it was, on comparing RISC to MIPS, IBM's power to MIPS. And it was differences between the two and how the compiler abstracted away all that complexity from the core processor. And if you were doing some interesting things in compiler optimization, you could actually get huge benefits out of how things worked.
Yeah, and it was even made the compiling easier in a way, because we used to, in compilers, we would parse the language down to an expression tree. So we get the language that what you're typed, the C code or Pascal or whatever at the time. Did a lot of Pascal stuff way back. And we would convert it into this data structure. And then we have to kind of like piece it back together to make these complicated instructions out of. And RISC, it made it easy because you didn't have complicated instructions. It pretty much just mapped very close to what you were doing in the data structures you already had. So less is usually more. There's a whole overarching thing in all of this stuff that really is simplicity is not optional. Simplicity is actually worth the effort. It's not just worth the effort. You will eventually fail given enough time if you're too complicated. Security breaches happen and cracks. Code bugs live between lines of code. If you got a lot of lines of code, then you're going to have more bugs. Very frequently, I will re-implement something that's already been implemented somewhere else and go back and look, and will be an order of magnitude or more less code than theirs, and go faster and have fewer bugs, of course. So the RISC was great because that allowed you to the processor to use that same design observation, which I learned from two different camps. I learned it from Nicholas Wirth, the famous Swiss computer scientist that invented Pascal, and the guys in the labs, reading Ken Thompson's code and Dennis Ritchie's code, and then eventually getting to know those guys. So what the MIPS, you mentioned MIPS. MIPS actually grew out of Stanford, where they were doing a project, because in the early 80s, the size of the silicon got to be where we could put a whole MIPS processor on the silicon, because it was reduced instruction set and you could use fewer gates. So you get near the end of the 80s and you got your choice of the processors.
Yeah, I think it was the R4000 towards the end of the 80s.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So now let's reflect on where we're at today with Meltdown and Spectre. You know, what can Intel do about these two vulnerabilities?
So let me first describe briefly what Spectre and Meltdown is, and I'll talk about Meltdown because it's a little easier for people to see. So we have this side effect that happens with caches. So when you load something into a cache, from memory, it comes into this little tiny memory on the die with the chip, with the processor. And that's to speed things up, because if you touch somewhere around that area of memory once, you're going to touch it a bunch of times, and then you're not going to touch it for a while. So they load it into this local memory, and then you touch it, and then you go off and look at something else. Well, there's a counter inside all of these Intel cores called a timestamp counter, which increments once for every clock tick. So usually it's running a couple of gigahertz a second, or up to 3 gigahertz a second. So you get a pretty fine-grained view of how long an instruction is taking. I mean, you read the counter, you access something, you read the counter, you know how long that took. Well, because of that, you can actually tell. If you flush the data out of an area of memory and then you go get it, you can tell that it went to main memory because it took like 200 clocks rather than like 2 clocks. So that's the first thing. So there's a couple of things work together. That's the first thing. The second thing is to observe is that in a modern operating system, all of the kernel memory, all of its data structures, and really you wind up with all of the other pages for other processors are all mapped into your address space. So the programs running have a virtual address space, and they have to map to a physical address space. Now, they don't want you as a user program accessing that, so there are attribute bits on the data structures that do this translation that using what's something called page tables to say users aren't allowed to access this, users are allowed to access this. So when you go to fetch memory from the programming point of view, if you try to fetch something from kernel memory, you're going to get an exception, which you can handle and say, oh, sorry about that, and you know, do something else or program exits or whatever you want to do. So that's thing two. So thing one is caching. You can tell whether it's in a cache or not. Thing two is, well, all of memory is really in your address space, even though you're not allowed to see some of it. Thing three is that because is the instructions are so complicated, keeping a pipeline going is difficult. So in order to have a RISC-like performance, Intel, starting with the late Pentiums, or pretty early Pentiums, actually, it was a few Pentiums, not like this, but since at least the 1990s have been this way, the Pentiums actually translate on the fly these complicated instructions and turn them into RISC-like instructions that they refer to as micro-ops. And all this is happening below the programming level in something called the micro-architecture. What the programmer sees, user programmer sees, is called the architecture, and the micro-architecture is how you implemented that. And that micro-architecture can change from family to family. Haswell is different than Broadwell, which is different from, you know, yada, yada. So in order to keep that, in order to be able to pipeline and make that work, they translate from these complicated instructions into reduced instructions, and they can fill more and more and more of them in the pipeline. Now, the problem with that is you just added more stages to the pipeline. And because you added more stages, it's now even more difficult to keep the pipeline full. So what did they do? Well, they said, you know what? We're going to speculatively execute instructions. In other words, we don't know if we're allowed to execute these instructions or not, but we're just going to go ahead and do them ahead of time. They're in the pipe. We're going to do them. Well, we can't do that one because you don't know if you have access to that memory. Well, we know, but we don't care. We're going to go ahead and do it anyway. We're just not going to show the user program the results. So all this is happening, and the idea is you say, like, I'm going to load memory from a kernel address. Underneath, he actually loads memory and keeps going several other instructions. Eventually, after you've done that, the processor gets word back that he's not allowed to touch that. So then he flushes those instructions out instead of retiring them. If he found out it was okay, he would retire the instructions, and the instructions are retired in order. And the programmer looks like he fetched one instruction, he did it. Then he grabbed the next instruction, he did that. That's the model we have as programmers in our mind.
Right.
In reality, he's doing a bunch of stuff ahead of time and at the same time. There's also functional units where he's actually executing more than one instruction at the same moment. So that's thing three, right? That he's speculative executing.
Right.
The very last thing is this idea that, and this is a view you can have from the architecture, regular application program, that you can load something into a register in the machine, and then you can use that register as an index into an array. So let's say I have 256 elements in my array, and I can say, load a byte from kernel memory, put it in a register, and then use that register to load another byte from my array. Now, that's instructions so tight, so close, that they can get executed speculatively. Now, how do all these things work together? Okay, well, the guy that wants to read some arbitrary value out in memory, in kernel memory, has this 256 element array. He flushes all of it out, so none of it's in cache. He then issues these instructions, load a byte from where I want to see into a register, and then use that register as a subscript and load my array into data out of my array. Now that execution will cause the cash to get loaded with that byte. Later, sometime later, the processor will say he's not allowed to load that byte in the first place, the first byte, and he will give an exception to the program. Okay, but it's too late. It's too late. That data in my array has already been loaded into cache. So when I come back from saying, yeah, my exception's okay, yeah, sorry, I promise not to do that again, you go through your array and you read every element in your array. And as you do, you see how long it took to load. Well, only one element in your array is going to be in the cache. That's the one that got loaded by the byte you read out of memory. And whatever subscript that is will be the value of the byte. So if it was a zero, the first element in your array will be load fast and the rest will load slow. And you go, ah, it was a zero. Or if the 42nd one was loaded, then you know that's the value inside the byte. So therefore, that's how Meltdown works. That is what using Meltdown happens. So you have this side effect caused by the speculative loading.
Amazing.
Now what can Intel do with that? How can they fix it? Well, they're just going to have to turn off speculative execution. I don't know any other way around it. And that will get rid of Spectre, which is slightly different, but much harder to explain. And not as bad, actually. It's worse and better. It's worse if you're trying to protect your browser from a JavaScript. It's better in that it can't read kernel memory. It only reads the process memory, but for an interpreter, that can be just as bad. So what can they do about it? Well, they're going to have to turn off speculative execution is what they're going to have to do, which is going to hurt their performance because they're not going to be able to load. They're not going to be able to load the pipelines are pretty deep. Their pipelines are like 18 and 19 stages. So that's going to hurt. There's a reason they were speculatively executing and to start with. It's going to give things like ARM a chance to maybe get into the server end of things. Because while some ARMs have the same problem, because someone decided speculative execution was, I don't know, maybe they had speculative execution envy or something. they put it in there. A lot of ARMs only have like 8 or 9 stages in pipeline, and they're perfectly safe.
Right.
Short term, it looks really bad. Short term is we don't have all of this kernel mapped into the address space, which means every time you do a system call, you're going to have to reload all that stuff.
Right.
And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it. So that's going to, you know, the performance number, 5 to 30%. I think in some cases it could be a lot worse. It purely is a function of how many interrupts you're doing, how many system calls you're doing, and how many interrupts you're taking. Because interrupts will get it too. Right. So that's the lowdown on the Meltdown.
So you mentioned, you know, they've got the architecture underneath it. They have the micro architecture. And, you know, most folks use Intel's compilers anyway, or some derivative of that, I would think. You know, is there any way that Intel could eventually just move to the micro architecture and move the architecture itself to an abstraction layer that sits in the compiler?
Yeah, no, for two reasons. First off, if they could have done that, they could have launched a new instruction set and they wouldn't have had to do all this. And since they can't, they're stuck with the macro architecture, the architecture level anyway. The second is they wouldn't want to do that because that micro architecture has changed a lot as the cost of gates declined. Now, since we're at the end of Moore's Law, maybe that's not so much of an issue anymore because, you know, transistors aren't getting any cheaper. Yeah. We're done. It's penny buys you 70,000 transistors. That's the number. You can get smaller, but it doesn't matter if it costs you a lot more, right? It wasn't that they're getting smaller, it's that they were getting cheaper. And so, you know, so their fix could be the only fix they can really have is to just turn off speculative execution. And, you know, you're going to have to wait to find out if you're allowed to get to that data or not.
Gotcha. So if we turned off speculative execution, obviously it's a hit to performance, but then you don't have to do this kernel page table isolation trick that we're
right.
Saddled with right now. So, I mean, do we have any idea what the hit to performance will be if we just turn off speculation
or speculation? I don't know what that number is. I'm sure I'm sure folks at Intel know what that number is. You know, it's kind of going to be like being in the summer in the South and wearing a fur coat, and then you take it off and it feels nice and cool. I think it might be that. We suffer with the having to reload the page tables, and then we go back to having it'd be a lot faster, but still slower than it originally was, and everybody feel better about it. So it's kind of like messing with the formula of Coke, right? So
yeah, I gotcha. I saw how that worked.
Yeah, the Coke today is not the Coke before, but because they did the new Coke, it feels better. So they and I could do that. I think it's a real possibility, though, that other board vendors will start to support more of an ARM possibility with it removed, and which will give them better performance. Even they could do that. I mean, Intel's got ARM processors. They could even – doesn't mean that Intel as a company would have a problem. By the way, our CoreAge stuff isn't subject to this. We're actually invulnerable to it. I wanted to make sure, and the reason I kind of did the research and the learning curve on it, our systems are embedded. Right. Our SRX and VSX are all running Plan 9. They're all embedded. They're only running our code. No other situation causes code to execute or anything else. So they're impervious to this, so we don't reload the kernel map when we take an interrupt. And besides, we actually put all of our functionality in the operating system itself. So we don't have a high interrupt rate anyway. And that kind of puts us an advantage of some of the other storage, you know, network storage vendors who are using Linux kernels and other kernels like that. You know, the good news is to them is they get all that kernel work for free from kernel.org or Red Hat or whoever they're getting the kernel from. Mm-hmm. The bad news is they're going to have to put up with this fix put in it, even though they don't do that, right? So they're like us, a closed embedded system, yet their kernel, which is already bigger and more complicated than ours by a couple of orders of magnitude, are going to take a performance hit that nobody's going to get any value out of. So that you know, puts us at a kind of a little bit of an advantage in this. But we're impervious because we don't run other people's code. It's all internal trusted code.
So now if I was to sum all this up for my mom and try to explain to my mom, you know, does she have to worry about Spectre and Meltdown, her laptop that's got an Intel processor in it?
Yeah, I knew everyone had a computer when I got one for my dad. So that was it. I know your mom and everybody. Yes. And when they get the update from that's coming out for her vendor, she should apply it. And it will take your performance a little bit, but the alternatives are worse. As I understand it, there's no known exploit right now, but that's only a matter of time. Right. Gotcha. I mean, now that everybody knows how to do it, and vendors have had the heads up. Right. I think they knew about this in June.
That's right.
Last year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so everybody's got fixes. Yeah. She needs to worry about it. She needs to apply it.
Just apply the updates. That's always a good idea. Well, any other parting words?
No, I appreciate it, Scott. Have your listeners check us out if they need smarter, faster, cheaper network storage. We are CoreAid.com, and take a look at it. Give us a call. Fill out the blog. I am starting to crank up my blogs more now. I've been doing a lot of LinkedIn and on our website, and sign up for the emails for that. I'll be happy to keep everybody in the world, at least the way I see it.
Well, folks, if you check out our podcast page, I'll put links to Brantley stuff. Brantley, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Okay, well, it's been Brantley Coyle and Scott Schweitzer for the Technology Evangelist.